Let the record show, we have Representative Salmon, Representative Ledoux, Representative Newman, Co-Chair Olson, and Co-Chair Thomas present. Since we cut the cruise ship people off and we didn't finish HB2 last time, we'll start with it and then we'll go through the other bills. And I believe it last time we finished with Representative Gatto's presentation. They don't have the list of people we had last time. Did they sign up again? But I do know that we had two people, Mike and we had a couple of people from the cruise ship companies there that wanted to testify. So at this time, we'll call them up.
Do you want to adopt the CS?
Oh, yeah. We have a CS in front of us. Hopefully, everybody got it. If not, okay, thank you. Co-chair?
I'll move we adopt the committee substitute to House Bill 2. Version L is the working document.
No objection. The bill is adopted. Okay, now we have our list, so we'll go down it. We'll start with John Pearson then. John here?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is John Pearson. I live here in Juneau. I have a business interest in Hyder, Alaska. And I'm speaking to you on behalf of the Hyder Board of Trade, which is the local chamber of commerce, and with the support of the district and city of Stewart, British Columbia. In the event that any of you are not familiar with Hyder, it's not Heidelberg, it's Hyder, and sometimes confused. But it is located on the Canadian border up at the end of the Portland Canal, which is about a 90-mile body of water. It's an unincorporated community with about 130 residents, and it has a very unique relationship with British Columbia. The community is directly linked to the lower 48 by a paved highway, and while it is isolated, tourism is the primary industry. Last year, during the months of June, July, and August, the U.S. Forest Service recorded 56,000 visitors, independent visitors, that came to view the bears at Hyder. At the same time, last year was the first year that the community was actively engaged in the cruise tourism industry. This next year we will increase port calls by about 300%, and those vessels are the small, very small vessels, sometimes known as the Explorer class vessels. I'm here speaking in support of HB 2 and also requesting two modifications to the bill. In talking with the staff of Representative Gatto, and they appear to understand what we are seeking. Those modifications are two. We seek specific mention of the Portland Canal, exclusion of the Portland Canal in the bill for that 90-mile stretch. This is because the Portland Canal is recognized as an international waterway similar to those waters that our marine highway vessels travel through coming up from Bellingham to Ketchikan.
We have a question.
Mr. Chair, John, where is that located in this CS? What page and line are we talking about?
All waters. What refers
all
to
waters.
All waters.
Where is that at?
Let's see.
Just to make sure that we're up on where we're talking about.
Yeah, let's see. It was Marine Waters of the State of Alaska. It's on line 10 of page 3.
I must have the wrong page.
Okay. Excuse me, just said that I've got the...
Yeah,
the other version.
We're on the CS.
Okay. Let's see.
Line two, page two.
Two, page two.
Or page four, line four?
Page two, line two. Traveling in waters, the marine waters of the state. Okay. Well, the reason that we're asking for an exclusion of the Portland Canal is that in navigation of the Portland Canal, which on one side is British Columbia, the other side is Alaska, any vessel that would be traveling between Prince Rupert, British Columbia, and Stewart, B.C., without ever making a port call in Alaska, would be required to pass through Alaska waters at a number of points. It's the same as our when we were operating a ferry to Hyder, Stewart from Ketchikan. Our marine highways often has to traverse or enter into the Canadian waters. So we would only ask that there is an exclusion of the Portland Canal. That's also the reason that the famous Jones Act, there are only two communities in the United States that are exempt from the Jones Act. One is Hyder, Alaska, and the other one is Savannah, Georgia. So there is a place for that change. The other is part of that modification. We would definitely expect that any vessel landing in or making a port call at Stewart is very much part of the legislation and considered as any other community in Alaska. The second modification that we would seek, and that is the inclusion of incorporated communities, unincorporated communities in the state. However, in saying that, I think there's a need within the, as the department would develop the ground rules for participation in the distribution of proceeds to require some documentation, something that would clearly indicate that a port call is a port call. And on that issue, I have to say that one thing that this bill does for our smaller communities, particularly our unorganized communities, is give them an opportunity to do some economic development in the area of tourism that they've not had before. For a community, a small community like Hyder, to have to meet the federal standards and the federal mandate of Homeland Security and secure the approvals of the U.S. Coast Guard and the Homeland Security Agency is a major task. I jumped through the hoops for our little community, and those were the same hoops that Anchorage, Ketchikan, Juneau, all the others had to do. So there is there's a good use of the of that mandate of the federal government is a good one in assuring that everything is on board as far as port calls. And with that, I would just like to say that I appreciate your consideration of those two issues. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, just a couple of questions. Does BC have a head tax right now?
No.
Okay, and that's right in part of the Portland Canal, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so you're asking for an exemption for Hyder, but still you want to receive some of the benefits from this?
We're not asking, through the chair, we're not asking for an exemption of Hyder on the taxation. I think that should, Hyder should be in there right along with every other community. However, we would like to be able to share in the proceeds, if that's possible. So once that vessel arrives in Hyder, ties up, then they're under the bill.
Mr. one more follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative.
John, I don't know, maybe I need to ask the sponsor of this bill on this, but would, maybe you might know, Hyder belongs, is that in an organized borough?
It's in an, through the chair, it's in an unorganized borough. So and we're anticipating within the next 5 years to incorporate.
So would that unorganized borough receive any funds from this bill?
Through the chair, no, I don't believe so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So should we call Cody up, see if he's got language? Or Cody, can you come up for a second?
Good.
Oh, yeah. Well, we're looking at him because he's... Have you got language that he's talking about? Or?
For the record, Cody Rice, staff to Representative Carl Gatto. Mr. Pearson and I spoke on this issue after I was alerted to it by an email he had sent, and we've spoken with Ledge Legal. I believe there were originally three concerns. The first concern was the exemption of vessels that strictly travel between Canadian ports and don't stop at Alaskan ports of call. The second issue and the third issue were concerned with the ability of Hyder to receive funds for vessels that stop at Hyder as a port of call. Our interpretation and Ledge Legal's interpretation of the bill is that it does not matter if you're an incorporated city, borough, unincorporated. If you are identified as a port of call, if the cruise ships tie up in your port and people get off, you will be considered one of the five ports of call, and you'll receive funds. The only place in the bill, to my knowledge, that it specifically references incorporated or unincorporated areas is the specific instance of an incorporated city within a borough. And in that instance, the idea was to split the revenues between the city and the borough, because presumably they share some of the maintenance and development costs of maintaining the port and harbor. As for the first concern of vessels traveling strictly between Canadian ports without stopping at an Alaskan port, it would be fairly clearly illegal for this tax to apply in that instance under MTSA. So we would hope that it wouldn't be applied that way. We, quite frankly, would lose if we tried to apply that. That being said, there is an amendment that I believe has been distributed to all offices that would specifically exempt vessels that do not stop at an Alaska port of call. I think it says something along the lines of adding vessels that stop at least one Alaska port of call, and everyone should have that.
Brings up, well, let the record show that Representative Scott joined us. I have a question then and follow-up. Is that commercial fishing, I see a lot of these smaller vessels that look like they anchor up and they don't go into ports, so you're going to exempt several hundreds or thousands of people that don't. I mean, they're impacting Alaska, and I thought the idea was if the impact on Alaska.
Through the chair, to the chair. That would depend on how Department of Revenue interprets the law. I suspect that anchoring up would not meet the MTSA standards for taxation purposes. I suspect that you would actually have to unload passengers.
Well, they do. And canoes and kayaks are...
In that instance, it's likely that would be considered a port of call.
Okay. Any follow-up, Cody? Okay, thank you. Do we have any other questions of John before we... No, thank you, John, Cody. Mike Windridge. I don't know if the record, Representative Sisno is here, but I think let the record show that she showed too. So I got Pete. Or Mr. Cott.
Not yet. Don't get too premature. Mr. Chairman, I do have some handouts, if that's okay.
My name is Mike Windred. I work for Alaska Travel Adventures. I live here in downtown Juneau and wanted to speak on House Bill 2. And I wanted to speak against House Bill 2. And a few things I wanted to point out. I'll come to these two McDowell Group studies kind of at the end and point out some highlights in those. But the things I wanted to address today is, first off, I think the House Bill 2, this is a punitive tax versus just a tax to raise money for the state. It has limited spending potential, as was pointed out in the presentation, which I don't think will help the fiscal problems that the state is seeking right now. It doesn't tax its intended target, which are the cruise lines. It taxes the visitor instead. Then I'll address the both the Tibble letter that was in the presentation, which would be the small little handout there, and I'll address the larger handout, which is just some general economic studies. And then the final thing I'd like to point out is will be that what happens with the dollars that the visitors actually spend, and I think that money will come out of basically business pockets or my pocket versus the cruise lines. Anyway, on the punitive portion, during the presentation last week, it became pretty apparent to me that one of the reasons for this tax would seem to be, at least, that because the cruise lines make a lot of money, that the state should get a portion of those proceeds. That doesn't seem to me to be the correct avenue for creating a tax. A couple things I'd like to point out. There's been no risk sharing by the state with regards to when they build a $600 million ship. If for some reason the economy goes south, things don't start to work in the state of Alaska, the state won't step up to the plate and help the cruise lines out. And there have been several cruise lines and small cruise lines that have had fairly financial hard times. You don't have to look much further than World Explorer Cruises, which isn't coming to Alaska at this point because they couldn't make enough money through the hard times after 9/11 to come back up to the state of Alaska. So there are several instances like that where if there was some risk sharing, that might make a little more sense, but there isn't any risk sharing. The other thing with regards to taxes, and one of the reasons that our industry continually says that we'd like a broad-based tax base rather than a targeted tax, to spread it out amongst everybody. The other taxes that were mentioned, timber tax, an oil tax, a fish tax, those are all industries that actually extract something from the state. Once the oil leaves the state, it's gone. Once you cut a tree down, it's going to take another 50 to 100 years for a tree to grow in its place. When a visitor comes to Alaska, rather than take something away, they leave stuff. Mostly what they leave is money, and they leave it with our businesses, and our businesses spend money in the state. As a corporation, we pay income tax to the state, and our corporation wouldn't exist if it wasn't for the cruise line visitor. On the limited spending potential, I think there's a few people who will speak to that after me in more depth, but it was mentioned in the presentation that there is very strictly only certain places you could spend money on a head tax from it. It's tied very directly to the ship and its cargo, and the cargo being a passenger, and that's going to be extremely limited. What you're not going to be able to do is send the money in the general fund out to the small communities that need the money the most. And what I'll point out in a little bit is that those are the communities that are going to be hurt most by a $50 head tax, or are going to be the outlying communities. This tax won't tax the cruise lines. It will tax the visitor through the port dues. That's going to be passed right on to the people traveling on the ship. They already pay a substantial amount in port fees and dues. One of the presentations I've been doing with Visitors Benefit Alaska, towards the end of my presentation, I'll point out what a visitor pays when they come to Juneau as one of their ports. Before they get off the ship, they're going to pay about $20 for ship pilotage fees, $5 in our local head tax, about a buck 18 in a port development fee, another dollar in a docking fee, this is per person, and a tonnage tax that ends up about 50 cents or so per person. So right off the bat, we're up around $28 before they've even stepped off the ship in Juneau. Now, they're also going to have paid a sales tax on tours that we provide, river rafting, salmon bakes, gold panning, et cetera. After those sales tax, they're going to help pay for a loading permit fee to get on my bus at the dock through the port. After that loading permit fee, they're going to pay a fee for use of the different lands, whether it's the Forest Service or to the city or to the state through DNR when we use state lands. Then we even pay, river rafting, a fee to the city at the airport to take our boats out there for a service portion. And I haven't even covered the expenses of the goods that we buy that we pay sales tax on, and then income tax as a business. So it's the visitor's already paying a pretty substantial fee for them. But the biggest thing to me is that if you charge a visitor that's paying, and we're having a pretty good year this year. There's no doubt that the visitor industry is doing well with regards to bookings this year, which is great. It's the first time since about 2000 that we're having a good bounce back year since 9/11. So we might have a good healthy year this year. But you take a $1,000 cruise per person, and you add on another $50. Well, for a family of four, that's $200. That a person's going to pay right up front, and they're going to pay it to the state of Alaska. The first thing that happens is if that person's still coming to Alaska, and we've shown that there's in actual surveys, 17% of the people said, if you charged an additional $50 per person, I won't come to Alaska. Then there's another, I believe, totaling up to 48%, including that 17%, that are marginal, whether they'll come to Alaska or not. So, but at a minimum, 17% have said, we're not going to go there if you're going to charge an additional $50 per person. But even for those people who come, the first thing that starts to happen is they're going to take that $200 for their family of four, and they're going to decide within their budget, what am I not going to spend or not going to do in Alaska when I get there? The first thing that gets hit are the more expensive backcountry or rural types of activities. So people that travel up to Brudeau Bay or out to Nome, doing some extended trips, maybe the Pribilof Islands after the end of a cruise, those are the first things to get hit. The next thing to get hit would be out of the rail belt, basically, the extended tours as they travel through the interior. And then the final things that get hit before they've decided not to cruise would be the shore excursions and things that are within the core. So what happens is all of that, the industry shrinks right back to the economic core, which would be Southeast Alaska and the rail belt through the interior. I can tell you this with a lot of certainty because one of our businesses that we do is motorhomes. And we were one of the lucky survivors after 9/11 in Anchorage of motorhome business. There are probably another 10 motorhome businesses that did not survive after that. We went from about 45 motorhomes, managed to stay alive in large part because of our 15 shore excursions we have in Southeast Alaska and a lot of years in the business and knowing what was going to happen. But we went back to 23 motorhomes, and we'll start expanding that again now. But just staying alive during that economic decline was somewhat difficult, but we managed to do it. There were a lot of companies that didn't. So I can tell you that when money is tighter, the first thing that happens is the more extensive backcountry trips or getting out into the rural areas are the first things that get hurt. Anyway. Going on to these little studies that you have there, I wanted to address the Tibble letter specifically. The first little handout that you have, the small one.
Oh, we're waiting for copies. Nobody's aware of the Tibble's letter, so we're
in the. I can tell you that. Oh, are those on the way?
I think they're right here.
Okay.
Hey, Mr. Chair. Yes. Can we maybe do a little bit of questions while we're.
Yeah, if you don't mind.
Sure, I don't mind at all. Yeah, please.
Yeah, Mike. I just had a couple here. Just listening to your discussion, it kind of came up. Just looking for some good information.
Sure.
You said that they the cruise ships, you know, do make a substantial amount of money doing this. But they don't pay any corporate taxes to the state?
They don't, no.
They don't?
But through the chairman, pardon me, some of their subsidiaries do, such as Gray Line of Alaska, the busing companies that do pay corporate income taxes to the state.
Thank you. Thank you. And then, Mr. Chair, you know, you had stated earlier that it cost an average of $1,000, you know, for probably the lower-priced end cruises. And then you went on to say, well, four people, that's $200. But that's $200 on $4,000, not kind of implied as $200 on every $1,000. We got to make sure we don't get that confused. But you also said that you charge a sales tax?
To the chairman.
Sales tax?
Yes. For all the tours that we provide, a sales tax is charged. That's correct.
At the local level.
Yes.
Just, so all you do is transfer the local level sales tax, or do you charge a fee on top of that also? Say, well, there's a 2% sales tax in Juneau. Do you just charge that 2% on everything that is booked out of Juneau, or do you get extra on top of that?
No, as through the chairman, as a company, Alaska Travel Adventures, so all the money that we collect for all of the shore excursions in each community is charged the appropriate sales tax for that community.
And all that money goes right back to that local community?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. I just had just one more question, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
You know, we kind of talk about the thing that concerns me, Mike, is I like to think of it as a user fee. You know, or if a company is using something, and I realize that the cruise ships, you know, the people that are going inboard, I know in the Mat Valley, we have upwards of 3 million people who come through there in the summertime. Now, it adds a tremendous amount of burden, extra burden on, you know, not just the highway and the people that use it, but police service, ambulance, hospital, fire, you know, all the emergency services to take care of these 3 million people. Besides making sure that we have the infrastructure available so that your industry can provide for these folks with water, sewer, electric, power lines, making sure that they're all there. You know, so this is a considerable amount of money that goes into a lot of the local communities. And I was kind of concerned about, you had made a statement, well, this the only reason that we want to have this head tax is so that we can support the general fund. I kind of don't look at it that way. I mean, a lot of these communities, this is a substantial cost to these communities, you know, and it's a real cost. And I'm a small business owner, too, and I also realize that small businesses also have to have pass-ons, you know. I mean, if I have to pay a sales tax on something, it all has to get passed on eventually to somebody. But, you know, it's just kind of a user thing where you're using so many services through the local communities, you know. Don't you feel that it's appropriate that something needs to be done to help substantiate these costs?
Through the chairman. I do, and having RV businesses and businesses throughout Southeast Alaska and some of them going into remote areas, I can tell you that when those services are used, I can't think of an instance where that person that was using that services, person that got injured, wrecked their vehicle, or if we had an accident where we wouldn't be paying for those things directly. I can tell you specifically from the local level in Juneau, for instance, that the services at Bartlett Regional Hospital are, they do fairly well off the visitor industry. We have a lot of services in the wintertime that we wouldn't have if it wasn't for the fact that they get a lot of business from the cruise lines that are paid for by those individuals, paid for by their health care programs. So I think most of those services are covered by the visitors when they come here. It's expensive enough to travel in the state of Alaska. You don't find many travelers who aren't fairly affluent, who can't pay for all those services to start with. So I would have a hard time believing, I guess, that there are places where there's a large burden on the state where those people aren't paying for those services.
Yeah. Representative Cessna and then Ledoux.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I Just looking at your outline, you talked about punitive taxing, and that the cruise lines bring something to the state. I got to tell you, at least from my point of view, and I'm very neutral about this, but from my point of view, I'm just instantly what kind of came off was garbage, pollution, and personally, the cruise lines. I have never been on a cruise line, but I've already spent a great deal of time worrying about and spending time on legislation to try to get the industry to clean up its act. So that alone is kind of one of those things that just leaves a bad taste in your mouth. There's the fact that I have been around talking to these different communities and asking them to explain their local economy, and what they explain is the things that have gone. Tourism is up, but tourism for them, all of the communities that I went to talked about it not being a real plus, because what it does is it brings in a lot of summer workers and people who build their industry for the summer are left in the winter with no income. And so those are the people that are going to be on state services in the wintertime. So that builds up a weight for the local community and the state. I mean, it's both places. And the medical services are used, but that never sounded as if there was a plus there, because a lot of these medical services are really stretched already in the rural, in the smaller part. Yes, Juneau does make money off of its hospital. It may actually make profit off of tourism, but I'm fairly sure it's the only one that does that. I haven't done a study on that, but I think that would be really worth thinking about. Kind of a problem. So as a user tax, this from just those things sounds like a user tax to me. It does pay for the fact that a lot of the services I see in Juneau here that have been built up for the cruise line industry are there for that purpose. And they weren't built by the cruise line. It was built by this community. So thank you. And if you please answer.
Through the chairman, I would agree with you, especially after a visitor's gotten off a ship, they've traveled into the interior, and they've gone to some very remote communities where maybe there's not as much visitorship. The issue would be, for me, with this bill, how do you tie the money and get it to that community if the money has to stay tied to the cruise ship and its cargo, which would be its visitors? At some point, it crosses a line where you can't spend that money out in a rural community because that person's no longer tied to the cruise ship. Whereas if you created, say, a 2% sales tax across the board, even a seasonal sales tax, you could spend that money anywhere you wanted in the state of Alaska versus a $50 head tax where you legally have to keep it tied to the cruise ship. So a broad-based equitable tax that you would collect from everybody, be able to spend it in rural communities, would seem to me to be a much better system for the state versus something where you have to keep it tied fairly directly within that core of travel of the cruise ship itself. That doesn't even include the core or the rail belt of through the interior.
Representative Ledoux?
I was just going to follow up on that before I got to my next question. But if you had the money from the cruise ship tax, which was going specifically to the communities which were more directly impacted by it, in order to meet the constitutional ramifications, there'd be more money in the state treasury, wouldn't there? That could then go. Other money, not the cruise ship tax money, but other money could then go out to those more remote communities, could it not?
Through the chairman, I think within the area that you'd be offsetting, that what I'll be able to show through the two studies is the state isn't spending a lot right now. That most of that is already either offset through the visitor, or there isn't a very high cost there at this point.
I thought you just said that there were pretty significant costs to those other outlying areas, but that they wouldn't really be impacted by the cruise ship tax.
Through the chairman, but the place you'd have to offset to spend that money, the general fund money elsewhere, would be within the core of where the ship is traveling. So that wouldn't include that rural community.
I guess, can I keep following up? I guess I don't understand that. In other words, you get this money for the cruise ship tax. So that gives the state treasury more money. So they spend it on the communities which are directly impacted. No constitutional problems at all. Well, once the problems there are taken care of, that leaves more general fund money for other areas. It would be sort of an accounting thing.
But maybe the first five ports, Representative Ledoux, get the money. After that, the rest of the money is in the general fund. And I think the problem is going to be, how do you get money to Point Barrow after when the cruise ship people got off in Skagway and took the bus? And that money, their share would be going into the general fund, and the chances of them getting any general fund money, the Barrow, Kotzebue, Antioch, any place, if they don't track them, the revenue sharing is the first five ports. The other $25 goes in the general funding, gets dispersed possibly statewide. And we know the chances of getting money to the rural area where people are going to would be a lot harder. I think that's what Mike is somewhat alluding to, is what. And you had another question before we...
I did. You've speculated that if we impose this $25 a head tax, that would have ramifications for other land-based industries. Juneau's imposed a $5 head tax. Do you have a study which specifically says that people have reduced their spending on land-based things by $5 a person? Have you done any studies which suggest that?
Through the chairman, there aren't any specific studies that I know of that address where people have spent their money due to that $5 head tax. But what I can tell you to answer that is in the same time frame that's happened, there have been several other huge factors where it would be a very tough study to do. 9/11 has happened in that time frame. Right after 9/11, we had an economic decline where people were not as willing to travel and part with their money coming to Alaska, which has seen a fairly large decline in highway traffic, for instance, has been a huge hit throughout the interior of Alaska. So trying to get that study done in with all those factors at the same time would be a fairly difficult one to do.
Do you think you'd be able to prove that people have, at some other time, if we didn't have those factors, do you honestly think that you'd be able to prove that everybody spent $5 less?
Through the chairman, I don't think a $5 port tax would have nearly the same impact as a $50 per person head tax. That, as Representative Newman mentioned earlier, there's $4,000. Usually a family of four is going to have some children's rate thrown there, so it would be less than that. But still, $200 for a family of four is a lot of money. When I'm looking at trips and planning out my vacation, and people can get online these days and they can see the cost of pretty much everything in their whole itinerary, they can find out the cost of my salmon bake, which is, you know, fairly reasonable. It's $30 for them to go to the salmon bake. $200 is a lot of money. They'll make a decision on where they're going to spend that money, and I'd prefer that money gets spent with me, and then I can spend it with the state, which will help the economy much more through jobs, et cetera, than going directly to the state and bypassing my tours and my employees. I think there are better ways and smaller little bits of taxes. If you took that $50 and you took it a piece at a time through a sales tax throughout the whole state, that person is going to be encouraged to travel through the throughout the state, get into the remote areas, collect that money in those different areas, and they might end up spending the same amount of money at the end. But the fact is, it is a little more, I guess, palatable than it would be in an upfront $200 charge where they're going to decide not to do something else.
Okay, then we have Representative Salmon, and then Sisson's got her hand up again. Representative Salmon?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Question I wanted to ask, I heard in the last go-around, is that does the other state charge taxes? I know the last time we heard the other countries paid the tax like this, but like California, Oregon, or, you know, Florida, maybe Washington or something like that, do they pay this kind of tax?
Through the chairman. Not that I know of. There probably a person coming up after me, Don, could answer that question better, since he's with the more tied directly to a cruise line than I am. But I believe there are no other head taxes. There are port fees in other states, which the state of Alaska already has port fees for each community that the ship visits, which would be the same as the other states. But there aren't any specific head taxes to enter the state, because there's some interstate commerce laws that deals with. So,
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Salmon?
This is kind of a little follow-up. If you pay that port fee, does that compare with, like, California and the West Coast over there? Does that price compare?
Through the chairman, I would be guessing if I answered exactly what that was, so that would probably be a better question for Don after me to find out what that is.
Representative Sisson, then we'll let Mike continue.
Thank you. Yeah, we've got just jumping through
That's
hoops
okay.
here,
That's
right and left. So here's my hoop. I know studies have been done on independent travelers and cruise line travelers, but what I don't know is, I thought that they were kind of dissimilar groups. That the independent traveler oftentimes comes to Alaska in different ways. Maybe they came on a cruise line first, but lots of them don't. Lots of them come other ways and go to the outlying areas. How many, have there been studies on how many of the cruise line passengers, and maybe the industry keeps track of that, go from the end of the line, whatever the package deal was, and take a separate trip while they're on that trip to outlying areas that are not a part of the tour? How many are there of that kind of traveler?
Through the chairman, I don't have an exact percentage. Yes, there are some studies that we could get our hands on about how many people post-cruise take those trips. For instance, part of our business, our RV business, we sell cruises, motorhome trips, and that's actually how our business actually started. We do more rentals now than we do actual cruise RV combinations, and partially because after 9/11, during the big economic crunch period right there, people weren't willing to spend that much money on a package. So, and the package was all inclusive, so it was more expensive, and it was very hard to sell. And the cruise lines, to get people to come up here, had to spend a ton of money on marketing, so their prices fluctuated a lot to try to fill beds to pay the big nut of getting the ship up here. I can tell you there's a huge tie in all the visitors that come to the state of Alaska with the cruise lines, and it happens through the marketing segment, the Alaska Travel Industry Association. The state has been helping a lot the last couple of years with regards to the marketing funds to help get visitors to Alaska. The cruise lines start off by spending well over $70 million marketing Alaska specifically. Doesn't include any of the other destinations. That creates basically an image of Alaska and a desire for people to want to travel here. What they actually end up booking after that sometimes are just trips. Some of them are people who just want to go out to the Pribilofs or just come up and stay at Glacier Bay. most of them are going to go on cruise ships because it's much more price advantageous for them to do that than traveling independent. But there are a lot of them that are going to come and book a motorhome trip with me as a rental. So, and then the state goes out between the state and a match with private businesses within the state, as well as the cruise lines also within that, which are the biggest portion of the private match that we do, that we then spend that money on the travel planner for the state of Alaska. And that's about $10 million, a little better than $10 million, that we spend in marketing the state of Alaska for that. And that, one of the primary focuses of that book is actually independent travel. Goes up through besides the interior, but there's sections for rural areas. It's a very big portion of why people ultimately get out to some of the remote communities, and the cruise lines are a huge portion of making that happen, both from the initial portion of why people desire to come to Alaska down to the actual marketing piece itself and being one of our biggest primary sponsors of that booklet, which does market cruises, but it also is the primary piece for our independent travelers.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Sisla?
Please, thank you. Remind me, I think I didn't catch you. The booklet is put out by the Alaska Travel Association, right? Or no?
Through the chairman. Yes, it is. It's the Alaska Travel Industry Association.
Right.
Which is basically the private marketing group.
Private with state subsidy. And it is the state essentially privatized it's because originally the state had a tourism advertising program, and it privatized that. And the cruise line industry has been helping that part. I just wanted to make sure I understood that. And you're talking about that you've used the motorhome section, but that's not really the really outline. That's still the road system. Yeah.
That's correct.
So that's the real outlying areas takes kind of some other transportation, like airplanes.
Yeah, through the chairman, absolutely. And that marketing piece is in large part how they get everything from names for people who are interested in that to direct bookings through the magazine itself, ads in the back, and small little.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Really appreciate it.
Just a quick question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Newman.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, Mike, you just mentioned that the state of Alaska and the cruise industry also now pays a lot for advertising, does a lot of advertising for the state of Alaska. But I know the governor cut quite a bit of money last year for the marketing tourism industry. I know that they used to be subsidized to a further extent. How much money does the state pay for that, do you know? But
through the chairman. I believe it's just a little over $4 million right now. It's a match, basically, okay, that we've come up with. There was an original plan of where we needed to get to end up with $10 million, and the industry had a very hard time getting there, to be quite honest. So this administration has actually been fairly decent in terms of making that an actual match, so they would match whatever we were able to come up with instead of setting an actual target that we couldn't come up with at the time. We were just shy of that. So it ends up being fairly close to $10 million in total. So it would be just under $5 million from the state and just under $5 million from the private industry, I believe.
You help pay into.
Correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Just for your information, Representative Sisna, on the McDowell report on page 24 may have some of your answers as to what, how many people go to the interior and what they spend there.
Good, thank you.
It shows there's $100 million spent in South Central and $28 million in the interior. It must be the passenger and crew spending. So, anyway, go ahead and go on. Mike, if you have anything else.
I'll just really quickly, I guess you have the Tibble letter in front of you now. I don't want to take up there's a couple people after me, so I don't want to take all this up, but, and your tip letter shows that there was, it's attributed, there's $115 million they're saying is attributable to, in state spending. And in response to that letter, which came out, I believe, last year, McDowell Group did a quick little study and took a look at that, at those spending. And if you go through the first one, which would be the small little handout that's there, there's a, you can go back through and see what actually happens with regards to state spending and the cruise line. And it kind of goes line by line, the international airport bond debt service, where we've got $5 million in the Tibble letters. Actually, the revised estimate is zero. And you can go right down through here and see how many things where, like Alaska Railroad at $7 million is zero because of the because there isn't any state funding that goes into Alaska Railroad that has to do with that. So bottom line, when you get down through all of the different areas that McDowell Group took a look at in there, you end up with, instead of $115,800,000 in state funds, there's actually only about $900,000, most of that coming through the Sport Fish Division and Fish and Wildlife Protection, and having, and both of those are based on a, strictly a percentage. And I can tell you, having run three sport fish businesses, that that they don't hire a lot of extra people to go out and do basically enforcement. That happens because it's already there. That and when you go and you ask the Division of Sport Fish, if the cruise industry went away and you didn't have those charter boats, how much would it hit your budget? And the fact is, it's for the most part only going to hit the revenue side. It's not going to hit their cost side. So I would actually argue the $600,000 and $300,000 that happens with regards to those. Anyway, so that's there's a huge difference in what you saw last week versus what the actual amount to the state is there. The larger booklet is just some general information on the cruise industry and the economic spending in general. If you go to page 2, which is just a few pages back, it does give you the overall spending for the state: $633 million in direct spending, $69 million in the interior and the north, $156 million in south central, $395 million in southeast Alaska, and about $13 million that's kind of unattributable there. Anyway, that's information for you to, I know you have several other bills on the same subject, so some good study information for you.
No more questions? Thank you, Mike.
Thank you very much for your time.
Can I ask for a brief at ease?
Brief at ease. We'll bring the CNRA meeting back to order here. This time we'll bring up Don Harberger.
Said they'll take a chance on the voter. If it passes, fine. If it doesn't, then we'll work it.
But we need to throw some amendments. Pete wants 35 instead of. State your name and social.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, committee, my name is Don Habiger, and I work for Royal Caribbean and Celebrity Cruises. I'm their regional vice president for government and community affairs, and have been in the shipping industry here in Alaska for the last 20 years. I'd like to kind of concentrate on a little bit, four sections. Mr. Windred covered quite a bit of this, so I'll try to make it succinct and hopefully brief. I'd like to talk a little bit about the uniqueness of HB2 as a taxation mechanism. I'd like to talk a little bit about the challenges to Alaska businesses that I think HB2 presents. The industry's own municipal sharing program, and then lastly, taking the words of Mr. Harvey, the rest of the story. So I'll try to talk to those. First of all, the uniqueness of HB2. I'd like to say that there is no other state that at this time has any kind of head tax like the magnitude of HB2 is proposing. There was some testimony at the last meeting that Hawaii does have a head tax, and I think you might say that Hawaii does have a head tax, but there are some, I believe, major differences, and I'd like to take a moment to explain those. The difference between Alaska and Hawaii First of all, is Hawaii has all state-owned harbors. They don't have any municipal or privately-owned docks. And because of that, it's all controlled by their Department of Transportation. And in their legislation, they do have a head tax, or I should say a wharfage fee, which is a fee for the use of the dock, based on the per-passenger fee, or a head, if you will. And that ranges anywhere from 35 cents up to about $5 per passenger. In addition to that, they have other fees in, as well, based on various mechanisms like length of the vessel, number of lines, that kind of thing. So they have a layered system. But their head tax clearly is not like HB 2 proposes. So those are the major differences between those two. HB would 2 would be breaking new ground in that regard. There are some challenges, as I mentioned, to Alaska businesses. And if I may, Mr. Chairman, I have just a brief handout. It's a one-pager that I'd like to just give to the committee, if I may. We, too, like the sponsor, have done a little bit of research on the potential that a head tax would, the potential economic impact that the a head tax of any sort would have on the consumer's perception of Alaska. And some of you will get a copy that's color challenged. My printer didn't do too well, but I think you can get the main points here. In 2001, the Northwest Cruise Association, which we are a member of, all lines that come up to Alaska market here belong to them, major lines, I should say, includes Princess, Holland America, ourselves, etc. We did some research. We asked a research firm, in this case it was an East Coast firm, that has done work prior to this in Alaska. We asked them to look at high potential visitors and ask them the a series of questions. But the one that I think is perhaps most revealing in relation to HB2 might be this one. And that the question was, how would a $50 or $100 head tax affect your expenditures? And the response was that it would have a definite impact on what they are spending, as you will, on the margins, or what they're going to spend once they get here. There may be some points of argument and disagreement over whether the industry itself will be able to generate, you know, their passengers, their carrying capacities, whether they'll be able to fill up their ships. I think that perhaps is more contentious, but I do believe, as Mr. Windred also testified, that as you get further away from the core economic activity, we're putting Alaska businesses more at jeopardy. And a little example as a case in point is one of our presidents of our ground tour was invited by the state to go visit Nome this last summer. And while he likes Nome, we are just, our ground tour company is in its fourth season here in Alaska, and we're not quite ready to expand into the outer regions. We typically use the rail belt as our touring venue. But to move up to Nome would be much more challenging if the cost does increase to go there. And I think this $50 per head would increase those costs. Next one, industry's own municipal sharing program. In that McDowell study that you received earlier, it talks about over $30 million that the industry pays for its usage of municipalities' docks. Also has private docks, if you will, particularly here in Juneau, Whittier, they built private. It also talks about the bed taxes we pay. It includes some airport fees that we pay out of that, employment, deplayment fees. So in all, we believe that the cost to the state and municipalities is not as much as we bring to the state. And then lastly, hopefully to keep it on the brief side, the rest of the story. There was a presentation by the sponsor of the bill that brought up an article about a lawsuit in the state of Florida. And I just wanted to correct, in case there were any misconceptions about that, that lawsuit was dismissed without prejudice. And the reason for that is it was a class action suit that indicated or alleged that our company in specific was in the practice of overcharging folks on their taxes and fees. Through investigation on that, we brought evidence to the Attorney General in the state of Florida, showed them that in fact we are undercharging, and so we showed them the cost that it has that we incur paying those taxes and port fees and harbor fees and pilot fees, tugs, etc., and that which we pass on. And there was certainly a difference. The Attorney General threw the case out. We brought that same evidence to the plaintiff's lawyer, and they also withdrew their suit. So there was no, in fact, basis to that accusation. And so that's my 4 points, and the legality part will be handled by one other. So any questions?
Questions? Representative Ledoux?
Yes. Representative Gatto pointed out something interesting to me while we were on break, and I wanted to ask you about this. At the end of a cruise, people are generally given envelopes by the cruise ship. I don't know who gives it to them exactly, but there are these envelopes, and there are a whole bunch of them, and I know because I've talked to people about this, bunches of envelopes suggesting how much they tip individual people on the ship, and they're usually quite significant, $50 to this person, $25 to that person. There are a whole bunch of them. Did the cruise ship industry ever worry when you give those envelopes recommending some fairly substantial tips to people? And believe me, I'm not against tips to the personnel of ships, that this is going to detract from the amount that people are going to pay on shore.
The audience is lively. Are we concerned that it detracts from onshore revenues? I would say that it's probably not one of those areas that we have considered. Again, the industry is a service industry, and like you rightly mentioned, in all service industries, or many service industries, and not all, there is a tip portion of employees' wage, and we do set suggested amounts. Those certainly are not mandatory. They are only suggestions. A tip is certainly at the discretion of the consumer of the service, and so that's how we handle that.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mike. Susan Burke.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Susan Burke. I'm an attorney here in Juneau, and I represent the Northwest Cruise Ship Association. And I want to take just a little bit of time. I don't want to take a lot of time. Just bringing to your attention some of the legal issues surrounding the committee substitute. I have seen version G. I have not seen version L, but I'm assuming that they're similar. At least I hope so. In any event, there are three areas of law that are involved here. There's the tonnage clause of the U.S. Constitution and the Marine Safety Transportation Act that Representative Gatto and Cody Rice have already brought to your attention. The Federal Act being really a codification of the tonnage clause. In other words, you have this provision of the Constitution that says you cannot impose a fee on a vessel based on its tonnage or capacity purely for the privilege of lying in port. And the federal statute clarifies to some extent what that constitutional provision means. The second area is the Privileges and Immunities Clause of the U.S. Constitution. And primarily, that clause tells us that residents of one state of this union enjoy the privileges of immunities of citizenship when they travel to another state. That's, the courts have called that, for lack of a better term, the right to travel from one state to another, between and among the states. And thirdly is the Equal Protection Clause, both of the U.S. Constitution and the Alaska Constitution, that says, basically, you can't treat similarly situated people differently unless you have a really good reason for doing so, in a nutshell. So let me talk for just a minute about the federal statute. I don't want to belabor it because it's been the subject of some discussion already, but I want to emphasize the language of the federal statute that restricts passenger fees. The proceeds from passenger fees have to be used only to provide a service to the vessel. This is a federal law. Alaska has to follow it. Every state in the union has to follow it. A service to the vessel. I understand Representative Newman's concern and Representative Cisna's concerns about impacts to communities from tourism. Some of that's cruise ship tourists. Some of it's not. But by law, these proceeds can only be used for services to the vessel. Now, traditionally, under the Commerce Clause, which the federal statute, it's, everybody seems to agree, was enacted to codify, those have been very, very limited. Marine pilot fees, harbor police, and I emphasize harbor-only police, harbor fire protection, docking facilities, wharfing facilities, those kinds of things. They've been very, very limited. There was one case out of Hawaii that counted bathrooms at the dock for small boats. But again, it's at the dock and in the port. So let's take a look at the way that this bill proposes to use these proceeds. You have $5 of the 50 that go to each of the first five ports of call, municipalities. 25% is then set aside, subject to legislative appropriation, I guess, to something called regional impacts for Prince William Sound in Southeast Alaska. And I think there was a reference, perhaps, and I may be thinking of the initiative provisions rather than this bill, to a distinctive region affected by cruise ship-related tourism activities. If you're not a port, I don't see practically how you can provide a service to the vessel of the kind that the tonnage clause contemplates, or the federal statute. Not only does it have to be a service to the vessel, it has to be a service that enhances safety and efficiency. Not just efficiency, but efficiency and safety. I can't think of anything that the state of Alaska, it's very difficult for me to conceive of anything that the state of Alaska, not owning any of the docks at which these vessels come to, could possibly spend this money on. So what's the point? Then you have the regional impact. Well, and I remember Representative Gatto, whatever it was, a week ago, when he made his presentation talking about the purpose of the head tax is to compensate the state for its contributions to the industry. Well, I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen, that is not a service to the vessel. Are there other things that a community might do or the state might do to deal with that? Sure, a broad-based sales tax that everybody has to pay, non-discriminatory, that might do it. But a head tax, you just can't get there for regional impacts or for the money that the state itself would collect. Now let's talk for a minute about the money that would go to the five ports of call. That comes the closest, at least facially, to meeting the requirements of the federal act. But as a practical matter, Juneau now charges $5 per person, and it's having a hard time coming up with projects that will come within the federal act, even at $5, let alone, you know, more than that. So, I mean, you know, the Juneau, for instance, built the facilities for the passengers to come off the vessels and get on the and get on the buses. That's a service to the vessel. It's close to the port. The farther away you get from the port, the less likely it is that any of the $5 head tax that Juneau imposes can be legally imposed. And, you know, the cruise lines every year when the assembly is putting together its budget, you know, points these problems out. That's the tonnage clause in the Federal Act. There's a whole different, I mean, let's assume that, you know, that there were, that this met the requirements of the federal statute. There's another constitutional provision that I mentioned earlier, and that's the right to travel. There's an old, old U.S. Supreme Court case, but I'm certain it has continued validity, called Crandall versus Nevada. And the state of Nevada imposed a $1 fee on every person who left the state by train or stagecoach. Went up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the court said, you cannot do this. People have to be able to travel freely from state to state. If you can charge a buck, of course the court didn't use the term buck, they said if you can charge a dollar, why not $50? Why not $1,000? And think about it from a slightly different perspective. Think about one of you traveling with your spouse and two kids on a motor trip through every state in the union. You know, the trip of a lifetime, you're going to hit every single state. So you get your car to Juneau, and you get on the ferry, and you get to Bellingham, and you're stopped at the, you know, when you're driving your car off the ferry, you're stopped by the state of Washington Tourism Tax Department. And they look in your car, and they say, oh, I see you have four people in your vehicle, and you're a non-resident, you're coming from Alaska. Well, we provide an awful lot of services to non-residents, generally speaking. So $50 each, $200 before you can come into the state of Washington. You get to Oregon, the same thing happens. You cross the border, there's a little toll booth, and you have to pay your, whatever, it's $200 to the state of Oregon. And then you get to California, the same thing happens, and on and on and on. And by the time you travel through your 49 states with yourself, your spouse, and your two kids, you've paid 10 grand in, quote, user fees. Our Constitution just doesn't allow states to do that to residents of our sister states, plain and simple, for obvious reasons. I mean, how can the Washington tourism tax collector tell, for instance, whether you're traveling on business or pleasure? I mean, we know that the Commerce Clause of the Constitution says you cannot discriminate against non-residents when it comes to doing commerce. So it's a serious constitutional impediment, even if you think you can get by the tonnage clause and the federal statute issues. But I want to talk for a minute about the concept of user fees, because that's been mentioned a lot. There's no question that user fees are perfectly constitutional, but there are limitations on them. You can charge them, but only to an individual who's actually using the service for which they are being charged. That's not the case here. If I'm John Smith from Dubuque, Iowa, I pay the $50 head tax if I never get off the vessel. And there are people who don't get off the vessels. So it's not a user fee in that sense. It's not a user fee in the sense that cruise ship passengers are a peculiar source of the impact that may be perceived by communities. People from Anchorage who might travel to the Matsu Borough for summer recreational activities cause impacts. So the second part of a legal user fee is it has to be non-discriminatory, and it has to be charged to everybody, residents and non-residents alike. And that's not the case with this head tax. So those are the main problems. You know, there are equal protection issues too, but those are often they're similar to the right to travel issues. And I just want to close by saying one thing. Representative Gatto last week suggested to you, who cares if it's constitutional? Pass it and let the court sort it out. I apologize if I am misquoting. I believe that is a fair characterization of the point that was being made, that, you know, you can argue about constitutionality, but that you all shouldn't be worried about that. And I'm suggesting to you that you do have an obligation to be concerned about that. You hear expert testimony on a variety of issues, on a variety of subjects. My testimony to you today, I like to think it's expert testimony, on legal issues is just like that. You have to make judgments about the seriousness of the concerns that I've raised and ask yourselves, is it worth it to enact something like this, knowing that it's going to be challenged and knowing that the state's going to spend tens and tens of thousands of dollars defending it? And what do you end up with in the end? You end up with a tax that, for all practical purposes, you can't impose. So I'm perfectly happy to answer any questions that anybody might have.
Questions? Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, so you talked a little bit about some of the federal provisions that feel this is in contrast to. The privilege clauses, the Tonnage Act, Equal Protection Clause. Is there any way that passenger cruise ships like this could work around so that there could be some middle ground between all this? Is there anything that you can see where they could work together in unison with this?
Mr. Chairman, for a passenger head tax, no. I actually don't have permission from my clients for them to pay me to advise you as to how to tax them legally. But I think I mentioned sales taxes. A broad-based, non-discriminatory sales tax is the kind of thing that might very well work. But this kind of a tax, no, and primarily because of this federal, well, there are two things. The federal statute that makes it crystal clear that you cannot use the proceeds of this tax for anything other than a service to the vessel and the right to travel, which I just described. So I don't think there is a middle ground if you're talking about a passenger head tax.
Representative Ledoux.
How I see in this handout that we've gotten from Michael Tibbons, from the legislative director, that there are a whole bunch of cities that charge what they call embarking, disembarking taxes. Have they been challenged constitutionally? And if so, what is their outcome? And if not, why not?
I have not researched each of those municipal taxes, but I want to stress that those are municipal taxes and they're all ports. I have not researched whether the amount that they charge is reasonable in relation to the amount of services they provide. I mean, remember, not only do these vessels pay, a head tax in Juneau, they pay substantial port fees every place they go in Alaska and every place they go every place else. Under the tonnage clause, those are perfectly permissible. Whether in a particular municipality they have, you know, they're charging more than they reasonably should, I can't answer that because I haven't researched it. But in general, I'm assuming that they are providing services to vessels because they're ports.
You have a question?
Can I follow up on it?
Okay. Then we have Representative Cotton.
So would the Interstate Commerce Clause, though, that would apply to municipalities as well as the state, would it not?
Oh, yes.
Thank you.
Representative Cott.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I haven't had the opportunity to look at the initiative. I suspect you probably have.
I've read it a time or two, Mr. Chairman.
It would have been included in the packet, but it isn't. At least I haven't been able to find it. Can you enlighten the committee on how the initiative would then dovetail into this legislation? How closely does it mirror it?
Mr. Chairman, I have not had a chance to look at the L version of the bill. The G version is fairly similar. And in terms of dovetailing, I don't know. I mean, are you asking what would happen if they both passed?
Perhaps.
Well, you might have a $100 head tax. I don't know. Mr. Chairman, I really haven't thought about that. I don't know. It's an interesting question, though.
Any more questions? If not, thank you.
Thank you very much.
We're going to hold this bill over. We were debating.
Mr. Chairman, is there any more to testify, or are we closing public testimony? I do have some questions. Maybe I can close to the.
Okay. No, we have no more people to testify, so if you want to have somebody come up.
I don't care who, somebody that represents the cruise industry in general maybe can answer just some general questions. I guess I'm the closest to a cruise industry representative. Okay. Is there any data out there, and I apologize, I haven't gone through all the stuff, I don't know if there's new stuff here or not from previous years, but is there any data out there that shows how many Alaskans actually participate in the cruise industry as far as taking these cruises versus the visitors, if you will?
Mr. Chair, again, for the record, I'm Don Habiger with Royal Caribbean. And Representative Cott, I don't think we've ever really done that research. I suppose that, you know, it's a matter of going back into the records and finding out how many reside in Alaska that take an Alaska cruise. But if I understand your question correctly, that's the only way to do that.
That was, in fact, the question.
We often look at, you know, our market share from various regions, but when we lump it together for our company, it's looking at the Pacific Northwest. I don't think we refine it down to states.
Is there a way to come up with that number that shows?
I would say possibly. I don't know enough about that
part of our large group.
I'd have to double check on that, to be honest with you.
Then secondly, Mr. Chairman, in the transitional language that would make this bill effective immediately, would it be safe to assume that if the initiative passed, and this went into effect, the initiative passing somewhere around November next year, I guess it would be during the general election, 06. Well, let me get back to the first question, then I'll get to that one. Do you have any idea when people, families, individuals who are contemplating taking a cruise, make that plan? Let's say I'm wanting to take a cruise.
9/11
this year.
If you would, it's changed again. The consumers' purchasing habits. You know, right after 9/11, the industry, and I believe it was the travel industry as a whole, saw a shrinking of time before the decision making process. We're actually seeing that expand out again. The cruise industry goes through what we call the wave period, and that's really the first few months of any year where the consumer makes that purchasing decision for a cruise that year or slightly into the next year. So it's about a year, give or take.
So then, if I understand you correctly, then if I were taking a cruise this summer, I would probably have made that plan sometime during the summer of old.
I'll say that's about correct. It's anywhere from a year to, I would say, 6 months generally prior to the travel.
Okay, so then if I were taking a cruise in May, I would probably make that on the minimum side. Made that commitment, or at least made the decision sometime in November. And I guess what I'm getting to is that if this were to take effect on the date, the effective date, there's certainly going to be a large number of visitors or Alaskans who have made that decision to cruise Alaska waters, probably have purchased their tickets prior to November, which my understanding of this, then the cruise industry would still be obligated to pay whatever tax, even though they did not pass it on to the consumer who purchased the ticket prior to transitional date.
That would be correct. We would be faced with a choice as a company and probably as an industry on whether to go back and ask the consumer, say this is an add-on, or we would choose to pay it from, you know, our profit.
I guess then the question probably should be directed to Sue. Would that be legal to go back and require, after a ticket has been purchased, to then say, okay, we can't, we're not going to, we've fulfilled our obligation. I mean, I think there's a contract there where I've sold you a ticket for services, you paid that ticket, now I'm going to go back and say, oh, I need another $200. Can you comment on that, Sue? I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think that's probably.
I'm not sure what the answer to that is, to be honest. You keep asking these very interesting, tough questions that would, I would like to think a little bit about that. I think I understand where you're coming from, and I suppose it has to do with the incidence of the tax. I mean, normally under tax law, a tax is imposed at the moment that the object of the tax takes place. If it's a sales tax, the tax is imposed when the sale takes place. Here, it's more like an arrival tax. So I guess I would have to say, in terms of traditional taxing concepts, the passenger would be obligated to pay it, even though the ticket had been purchased, because it's not based on buying a ticket. That's not the incidence of the tax. It seems to be the person's presence in Alaska, and that doesn't happen till the ship comes in. I don't know. That's off the top of my head. Further analysis could change my mind. I've often been able to change my own mind.
So you're saying you could actually perhaps impose a retroactive tax?
It's not a retroactive tax if you're imposing it on the act of arriving in Alaska.
But as an industry, you're out there advertising in August for a cruise next year, and probably, I'm guessing, I haven't been on a cruise in a number of years, but I'm guessing that there's some form of advertising that suggests if you buy this cruise now, you know, beat the other rates, we're going to give you a good rate here, and it says $900, Alaska, five-day cruise, $920, everything included. And then after the fact, you're going to come back to me and ask me to pay an additional tax because somebody's imposed a port tax?
Well, it's not just somebody. It's a state government, and it's not just a good idea if enacted. It would be the law. And, you have...
cruise industry, Sue, then if that were imposed on me and it broke the bank, would the industry then refund what I've paid for that ticket?
That becomes a business decision. I don't think the cruise line would be legally obligated to do so. I suppose you could construct some sort of, truth in advertising contractual argument between the passenger and the cruise line, but I think that would be a pretty dicey kind of case. But beyond that, I think, as Don mentioned, it just becomes a business decision by the cruise line whether, even though technically the tax is on the passenger, whether the cruise line is going to cough up the money to reimburse the passenger. And again, I could talk myself out of that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. We're going to close testimony.
But I do have a question for you.
that do. I'm just not sure where she was going with this. You had mentioned something about an envelope being passed out for gratuities or something, and I wasn't really sure where that dialogue was heading. And again, I've only been on one cruise, and it's been a number of years ago, and I didn't remember getting an envelope, but you know, maybe there was, or maybe there was something left in the room that says, you know, suggested gratuities for the porter, wherever it is. But if you can just enlighten me into where you are heading with that. I mean, does it affect your offshore spending, I guess?
That's where? Simply where I was heading on it. The cruise ship industry has testified that a $50 head tax is going to significantly impact what people spend offshore. So I was just wondering whether they were concerned with when they put out these envelopes at the end of a cruise suggesting various substantial gratuities, which I don't have any problems with, gratuities for the staff of the cruise ship. I think that they're entitled to those. But whether they're equally concerned whether that's going to impact spending offshore. That was my only question.
Okay, thank you. We're going to hold this bill over and try to bring up House Bill 49 today, and then we'll hear the other two on Thursday. So we'll call Representative Roepberg up if we can. And we don't need any more testimony. We've heard the bill. There is a. Have you received the amendment, Representative Roepberg?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Roepberg, District Attorney Sam Anchors, you're referring to Amendment G1 from Representative Salmon?
Yes.
Yes, I looked it over, Mr. Chairman. As I was indicated before, I would ask the committee not hug a bill to death. One of my concerns right now is to make sure we can get the bill moved so I can go up and beg Finance Committee to hear the bill. They're not waiting for this bill, Mr. Chairman.
Right.
You know, so. And Mr. Chairman, I just ask that the committee do whatever they feel comfortable with doing. I would say, it's come to my attention without researching it too much, I could be incorrect in this, but I understand that Representative Salmon's amendment asked to add some $10,000 for communities, non-incorporated areas. It's my understanding that previously, before revenue sharing was completely unfunded, that amount was granted, and it was down to $3,500 per community, as I understand it. I'm not sure if that's correct. But Mr. Chairman, I guess my goal is to try to manage the fiscal note here and not increase it. I would be, I just ask the committee to take this up, whatever makes you comfortable. If it's adding the amendment, I would only defer to the judgment of the committee, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, I would suggest that in order to take up the amendment, discuss it, that Representative Salmon ought to at least offer the amendment so that we can then debate the amendment.
Move the amendment?
Yes, I do.
And I'll object for the purposes of discussion. Now that we have
before
us, maybe Representative Salmon can explain the amendment to us.
Yeah. What this 28 does is it gives all the municipalities $10,000. And
49.
Oh, 49. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, but
I'm talking about Moses. Yeah, 49. 10,000 per municipality, and I indicated last time that it's kind of unfair to the unorganized communities, the smaller communities, that we're not getting any. And I think 10,000 just came out of the air, but I mean, the original amount I think was 3,500, and even if we go back, like, you know, 50% of that 10,000 will be fine, you know, or, you know, even 3,500 will be fine, you know, just to say we, you know, consider that.
Will you change your amendment to 3,500?
I think even 35 would be great, you know.
Will you move it?
I'll go ahead and
move your objection. The amended to 3,500.
I have no objection to the amendment.
Mr. Chairman, are you going to be amending amendment to the amendment?
You're talking,
yeah.
That is line 5 on the amendment.
$10,000 to $3,500.
Right.
$3,500 will be great. No objections? Amendment moves? Should we? amendment to the amendment moves, the main amendment.
Mr. Chairman, you have amendment number one before you?
Yes. As amended. And moved. Is there any objections to amendment number one?
As amended?
As amended.
As
amended. Yes. Hearing none.
Still going to object, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Objection. We have a vote. A discussion. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Roekberg, didn't the House just pass the revenue sharing program, or didn't we, in HB 98, or didn't we have a revenue program,
fuel.
Or I guess that was a fuel fuel cost bill that went through?
Oh, Mr. Chairman, I believe we did add some $6 million for fuel assistance to those organized communities from throughout the state, as I recall it was.
Right.
Yeah, we expanded that or
no organized, unorganized weren't taken care of in that.
Yeah. Were they in? I can't remember.
There was an amendment on the floor for $3,500 for unorganized, and it failed.
It failed. Oh,
okay.
Right. So they're not taken.
But quite a few of these municipalities are already getting up to $67,000.
No, none of these will.
None of these will.
No. None of that the amendment will cover are unorganized municipalities.
Mr. Chairman, this, and just specifically, the bill was intended more not as a fuel assistance per se, but didn't have any strings attached. So
right.
Those items that were discussed in terms of insurance, grants, just the administration of the community, which I think is important for the cohesion and keeping together was the intention. So, but it could be used as fuel, but that was, Representative Newman is correct, there was a
right.
appropriation made.
You want to vote on the amendment? President Cott. Roll call vote.
Representative Cott?
No.
Representative Ledoux?
Yes.
Representative Newman?
Yes.
Representative Sisna?
Yes.
Representative Salmon?
Yes.
Representative Olson?
No.
Representative Thomas?
Yes. Amendment that passes. Main bill, wishes of the committee. We have five to two.
Mr. Chair,
I move we pass HB 49.
As amended?
The committee.
As amended?
As amended.
No objections. Bill moves from committee. We are adjourned till Thursday to pick up the